What's up, everybody? It's another edition of The Throwback. It's your host, as always, Ryan the Potman.
And me, Jimmy the Radio Man, Daddy.
We've got a cool show lined up for you today. If you're a wrestling fan, the author of the new book, WCW Nitro, The Incredible Rise and Inedible Collapse of Ted Turner's WCW, Mr. Guy Evans, will be our special guest today to talk about his new book. Hey, oh, Jimmy, what's in that box? Are you still looking at Pogs again?
No, I found these old wrestling figures in my uncle's attic. Look at this, it's a mid-condition Glacier Jackson figure. You remember him? He was that Mortal Kombat looking guy.
Yeah, I remember.
Oh, hey, look at this. It's one of Disco Inferno. Man, he was cool. Disco Fever. Disco Fever. Disco Fever, Daddy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's enough, Jimmy.
Hey, is this guy going to talk about the time that Dungeon of Doom tried to end Hulkamania?
No, Jimmy's not here to mention that.
How about that time when Ric Flair got locked up in that crazy asylum?
No, Jimmy, he's just going to talk about how the company...
Oh, how about that Judy Bagwell on a pool match? That was so cool. I can't believe
it. Jimmy. He's coming on to talk about his book and look at the business side of what was going on behind the scenes in WCW during the Monday Night Wars and the process of writing his book.
Oh, hey, guy. Oh, I got you, Daddy. But maybe it's a good thing he has to talk about that Judy Bagwell on a pool match. That match still gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Anyways, folks... Make sure to check us out on Spotify or iHeartRadio for more exclusive interviews. Also, be sure to check us out on Twitter at ThrowPodcast, THROW Podcast, and drop us a line. Now, here's our exclusive interview with the author of WCW Nitro, The Incredible Rise and Inedible Collapse of Ted Turner's WCW, Guy Evans.
You are listening to The Throwback Podcast. Your stop for everything 90s. This is a throwback exclusive.
Joining me at this time is the author of the new book, Nitro, The Incredible Rise and Inedible Collapse of Ted Turner's WCW, and is also the co-host of the Secrets of Nitro podcast with Neil Pruitt. I am pleased to welcome Guy Evans. Guy, thanks for coming on.
No problem at all, Ryan. I'm happy to be here.
All right, let's get started. What's your background in terms of wrestling like? Were you a big wrestling fan growing up?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think like many other young people, during the mid to late 90s, I was a big fan of pro wrestling, and I actually followed both the major organizations very closely, both the WCW and the WWF. And when WCW went away, which fans such as yourself, Brian, will know was in March of 2001, that was really the extent of my interest in professional wrestling, to be completely honest with you. Mm-hmm. I know that I stuck around that summer for the ill-fated invasion storyline.
Yeah.
A portion of the WCW roster came into the WWF.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think I stuck with it up until the end of the NWO, which of course was a faction of invading wrestlers that was created in WCW when they tried to revive that concept in the WWF in 2002. So at some point in 2002, I sort of bowed out, as I think many people do at some point in their sort of fandom with wrestling, or for that matter, many other forms of entertainment. You sort of just move on to other things and develop other interests and so on. And it wasn't until, believe it or not, around 2009 or 2010, when I became aware that TNA Wrestling, which of course now has been rechristened Impact Wrestling, was attempting to essentially recreate or reignite the head-to-head competition that WCW had with the WWF back in the 90s.
Right.
And that's really what got me thinking about WCW again. And it was the first time in a long time I really sort of thought back to those times and remembered how closely I followed it and how much of a fan I was. And to make a long story short, that was the beginning of a thought process, I suppose you could say, that eventually culminated in this book being published.
Right. Yeah, that was such a magical time around when WCW and the Monday Night Wars were going on. So what's inspiring you to write this book now? Like, there's been so many different books, like The Death of WCW, The Rise and Fall of WCW DVD, and there's other publications out there. What's inspired you to do this now? Like, how has this book different from the other books and DVDs out there?
Sure. Well, I think I know you mentioned off the air, Ryan, you've just begun sort of diving into the book, and I think the more you get into it, the more that answer will become apparent to you. Mm-hmm. But I think, broadly speaking, there are a number of reasons why I wanted to write this book. If I could just sort of go back a second, you know, I talked about the short-lived reduction of the Monday Night Wars in 2010.
Right.
When TNA Wrestling, you know, decided to take on the WWE as it's now known, of course, and that didn't last very long. But it was around that time, to answer your question, that I started looking at some of these other accounts that are out there on the WCW story, the various you know, DVDs and books and articles and so on, and I found them all to be very informative and entertaining and very useful. But as someone who followed it very closely back then, there were still quite a few questions that I had, which I didn't think, personally speaking, had been adequately answered for. One of the things that I noticed was, in many of these attempts, the perspective that you were hearing tended to be the same ones. And as someone who, you know, knows a little bit about how sort of large organizations work, as I'm sure many people listening to this do, you know, you're aware that there are many different divisions that comprise an entity such as WCW, and that's not to mention, you know, the people working for its parent company, which of course is the Turner Broadcasting.
Right.
So I thought it would be really interesting to hear from perhaps a broader range of perspectives, especially people who work in finance, in legal, in production, marketing, public relations, and so on, of course, alongside some of the talent themselves. And I thought, you know, it would be interesting if someone would possibly approach it from that angle and really sort of look at WCW as more of a business entity as opposed to examining totally the on-screen product. And I think if you read this book, you'll see certainly some of the more important on-screen moments are, of course, discussed and dissected and so on. But I think the short answer is I felt that there was maybe a richer, broader story that could be explored. And I got to a point where I said, you know, if no one else is going to attempt this, I will. And, you know, here we are now in 2018. I started work on this back in 2015. And I think the outcome is, you know, the risk of sort of sounding hyperbolic. You know, a very original story and a very original account of WCW's rise and fall, which I think not only introduces a ton of new information, but also brings some other perspectives to some facets of the story that have kind of been accepted as being reported in one way or another. So that's the predominant piece of feedback that I've got from reading the book so far. They've just been very impressed, it seems, with the amount of new information in the book.
Yeah, I agree. The first few chapters I've read so far, it is a fresh perspective. You're looking at it from a different angle, from actual company entity perspective, in terms of just like the whole TV production aspect of it. I think that's actually a cool way to go about doing this book. Now, you said you've, how long did you say it take you to write this book?
Yeah, so the first interview I did was back in January of 2015, and I suppose that brings me on to something in regards to this book, which I think is worth emphasizing, which is this is a book that's informed by over 120 interviews, both people who work for WCW specifically, and as I mentioned, people who work for the broader corporate entity at Turner were interviewed for this book. You know, I also was lucky enough to have access to a lot of company records and materials, which have, for all intents and purposes, been under lock and key for the best part of 2 decades. So, as much as is possible, you know, when you're writing a book like this and you're doing anything that's nonfiction, you want to try to remove the subjectivity as much as you can. And I think the fact that this is informed by people who were there, and as I mentioned, I had a lot of sort of objective data and records to cross-reference some of those comments and recollections with, you know, comprises, again, something that I think is very original. So it was about 3 years from the time of the first interview to the last interview. And there's some people may know who are listening to this. The book just came out a few weeks ago.
Wow. Now, you say you interviewed over 120 people, like executives and former figures from WCW. How were you able to get all these people involved in your project? Like, did you have a hard time getting these people?
Yeah, that's another interesting question. It's one that I've been asked a lot. You know, I've been quite pleased to see just an incredible response since this book's come out. I've got so many emails from readers who have contacted me and asked similar questions to the one that you just asked. I think what kind of happens, at least this was my experience doing this book, is it's almost like a domino effect where I think the first handful of interviews that you do are the most important in terms of establishing your credibility, understanding that if you're going into a world, let's say, and you're contacting people who worked side by side, or at least you know, in some form or fashion within an organization, you know, you have to understand that word is going to travel fairly fast, that there's someone out there who's asking questions and putting together a book on this topic. So I think, you know, provided that those initial few interviews can go well, when you reach out to other people, you can sort of do so with the knowledge that, you know, likely if you have been talked about, it's been in positive terms. So I think that's something that I found to be true. Once I got those first few out of the way, you know, a lot of people were happy to introduce me to other people. As I mentioned, I think sort of the overall perception of the book was a positive one for the most part since the beginning of the project. So it really was like a bunch of cascading dominoes, really. As the more interviews you did, the more people that I was introduced to.
Oh, wow. So when people reference the downfall of WCW, they always say things like the finger poke of doom, or David Arquette winning the world title, or Vince Russo coming in and messing up the company. And those are some of the things that are often referred to. But based off the research you've done, like, do you think maybe some of those events that are referenced may have been maybe kind of overstated or had less of a negative impact on the company compared to what was going on the Turner side of things, do you think?
I would say I'm not sure they've been overstated. I think a lot of the things you mentioned there, and this is just, I'm speaking subjectively now, and I try not to do that in the book.
Yeah.
I think those things, obviously, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, and even at the time, I think people identify those correctly as mistakes.
Right.
In terms of some of the things you mentioned there. But if you look at the subtitle of this book, you know, the book is called Nitro, The Incredible Rise and Inevitable Collapse of Texas and WCW. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things you'll take away after reading this book is as long as WCW was under that umbrella of Turner Broadcasting, and the more that you go into the book, Brian, you'll see just how dysfunctional that relationship was, and how more dysfunctional it became over time. I think as long as WCW did not have a full sort of degree of power over its ultimate destiny and over its affairs, it was always destined to go off the airwaves at some point. And again, I'll be interested to hear from you once you've read the whole book, because I think that will become quite apparent to you, especially once you get into the final few chapters.
Okay.
Yes, I think that they were mistakes, but in the final analysis, WCW's going away or cancellation was inevitable for a lot of reasons that the book explores.
Now, I find it very interesting that the cover of this book is Kevin Nash powerbombing Goldberg. After all the moments from Nitro and WCW, that was the cover used. Is there a particular reason, or was it just like a cool picture?
I don't think there's any sort of deep psychological meaning behind it, other than I think it's a good image to be on.
Yeah, it is a pretty cool image.
And also I think it's regarded as a major occurrence, which happened, if you think about it, right at the midpoint of the Monday Night Wars. And of course, you know, many people look at the defeat of Bill Goldberg and him losing his undefeated streak as being a big turning point, and that's something that's addressed in the book with comments from Kevin Nash himself and Eric Bischoff and Kevin Sullivan and so on. So I think those two factors combined, it was a pretty cool image and also a pretty major event during the whole Nitro era, even though, of course, it wasn't actually on an episode of Nitro.
Right. Now, is there anything in particular while you were doing your research for this book that genuinely shocked you, or at least made you raise your eyebrows a bit, like really surprised you? Like anything stand out?
Yeah, there were a few things that I think could be described as revelations in this book. I think the very first chapter sort of introduces an added layer to the story, specifically in regards to how WCW ended up on TNT, which I know hasn't been talked about before. I think there's something that's referenced about two-thirds into the book, which once you get there, you'll see that kind of changes your whole perception of the entire Monday Night Wars in many ways. So there's a very interesting story specifically involving Harvey Schiller, president of Turner Sports and for a while by proxy WCW. And also I think the information on WCW cancellation and ultimately its sale to the WWE or the WWF at the time, there were a lot of things that I uncovered which were at the very least surprising and also somewhat shocking. So I think that's again sort of the main takeaway that people have come away from this book with is, a lot of people have said, I didn't realize there was so much to this that I wasn't aware of before. But those are, there are three things, as I said, at the beginning of the book, sort of two-thirds in it, and at the end of the book, which, in hindsight, now I look back and say, those are quite shocking in terms of the fact that it hasn't been sort of uncovered before, just the general nature of those things.
Wow. So you said you interviewed over 120 people for this. Is there a particular person out of all those interviews that you enjoyed interviewing the most, or you learned the most from?
Yeah, I think, and this is a name that I'll throw out there and probably won't be known to the large majority of people listening to this, but there's a guy by the name of Bill Burke, who was, in fact, the president of the TBS network. And I had the chance to actually meet with him in person, as I did with a small handful of people. And that was a tremendously positive experience, sitting down with him and learning a lot about how WCW was perceived within the Turner organization, learning a lot about sort of the media landscape at the time and soaking up his knowledge on television and the importance of ad sales back then, and just many other topics that the book references as well in terms of including his comments. So I think that's probably the interview that stands out the most. On the performer side, because I know, again, for you, Ryan, and a lot of people listening to this, of course, we'll be more familiar with the actual wrestlers themselves. I think speaking with Buff Bagwell was actually a very positive experience in terms of his enthusiasm to be part of the project, some of the stories that he told throughout the course of the interview, how honest he was and open he was in terms of reflecting back on some of the things that happened. That's another one that stands out in my mind in terms of an interview that I got a lot from. And also the fact that, as I mentioned, he was just very enthusiastic about being interviewed to begin with. So that's probably the one that stands out on the performer side.
Wow. Yeah. After doing all your work on this book, do you feel like Daisy Day's collapse and eventual death could have been avoided, or was it just a matter of time? I think we kind of might have touched on this a little bit already, but do you think it could have been avoided?
Well, you could take that question and that particular topic in any number of directions. I think, generally speaking, again, as long as WCW was an entity that did not have complete control over its destiny, it was pretty much inevitable that something like what happened was going to happen. I think if you want to get a little bit more specific with it, and you some people listening to this might be aware of, of course, Eric Bischoff is a major figure in the story, and his attempt, along with Fusion Media Ventures, which was an investment company based in New York, co-founded by Brian Vidal. Some people may be aware that this company, Fusion Media Ventures, was almost successful in terms of taking over WCW right towards its end. But one of the details that hasn't been uncovered before, and this is something Ryan Vidal talks about in the book, is a key provision or a key condition of the purchase agreement that actually sort of forced the hand of a guy by the name of Jamie Kellner, who was coming in as the CEO of PDF at the time. And the book goes into that in great detail. So, in other words, you can look back on this and you can say, well, if that sale went through, perhaps WCW would have continued for years to come and ultimately, you know, challenged the WWF again and maybe, you know, been the number one wrestling organization again at some point in the future. But if you read those last few chapters of the book, you'll see because of the nature of that sale, really that wasn't going to be sort of a viable option as far as some of the term of people were concerned. And I'm trying to speak in general terms here so I don't give away the
exactly, yeah.
But I think, again, that, you know, the general answer is, you know, of course, the last couple of years of WCW, there were a lot of things that happened that I think people could accurately identify as being creative missteps or creative mistakes. But ultimately, there was a lot more going on at the corporate level that really had more of a say and more of an influence in terms of what actually happened with the company.
Right. I know when you're looking at the WCW product on TV back when it was on the air, you didn't really start noticing like an actual decline in the actual product, I don't think, until like maybe early, mid-99, I would say. When you were doing your research with on the corporate side of things, does that line up on the corporate side as well when stuff was starting to go down, or you think it happened well before 99?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I think one of the things that you have to keep in mind when you're sort of trying to pinpoint, you know, exactly when the decline happened, is if you think about it, especially back then, you know, there's always going to be somewhat of a delay between when the on-screen product starts to dip a little bit and when that becomes actually evident to an audience at home. So a very simple example of that is if you think about the nature of ticket sales and the fact that, you know, back then at least, you know, and this wasn't the case with all events, but in many cases, tickets would go on sale for an event maybe 2, maybe 3 months before the event actually took place. And in that intervening period, it could actually end up that, you know, episodes of Nitro weren't very entertaining, the ratings could be going down and so on. But those tickets were already sold, and that arena was still going to be full, if that makes sense. So by the time that event takes place, you know, it looks like you have a full arena that's full of energy and people are really enthusiastic about WCW. But that those transactions actually took place maybe when the product was at more of a peak. So I think, you know, you're always going to have a little bit of a delay as far as that's concerned. Also, I think it, you know, and this is true, I think, for any sort of genre of entertainment. And you can think about your favorite, you know, television show, and everyone has their own opinion in terms of, you know, when various shows reach their peak and then they start to decline. I think the role of momentum also has a lot to do with it as well. You know, it took WCW a long time to build the requisite momentum to become unquestionably the most popular weekly wrestling program. And I think similarly, it took a little bit of time for the message to sink into viewers that, you know, perhaps it wasn't as entertaining as it had been, and that competitor had actually sort of turned the corner as well. Objectively, if you look at it, you know, October 98 was the last time that they actually won in the ratings war.
Right.
So, you know, that could be one thing that you look at in terms of saying, you know, when things from that standpoint took a bit of a downturn. But I think most fans would sort of commonly agree that around spring of 99, that's when the ratings competition really started to get out of hand. You had a lot of things happening where a number of wrestlers were changing their character dispositions. A lot of, you know, the good guys were turning bad and vice versa, sometimes for no rhyme or reason, you know, whatsoever. And that led to, of course, the summer of 99 when WCW seemed to be trying anything they could to try to grab that momentum back. And that's something the book explores in great detail. So if you're asking my opinion, I would agree with you with that general timeline. But again, once you read the book, I'll be interested to see what you think about that.
Yeah, looking forward to reading that part. Without giving too much to the audience about your book, when you're... on the corporate side of things with Turner and everything that was going on, do you, in your opinion or from your research, do you believe that any stuff was happening on purpose to make WCW fail, so, in your opinion? Or do you think it was just a collection of bad decisions going on?
Well, certainly I think one thing that becomes evident as you go deeper into the book is understanding that the perception of WCW within TBS was, generally speaking, not a positive one. Of course, Ted Turner himself had been a supporter and a defender of WCW. What his motive was for that is something that the book explores in one particular chapter,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that a lot of people have various theories on. You know, there are some people who claim that Ted himself was an avid wrestling fan. Other people opine and say that it was more to do with the ratings component, or it was more to do with the fact that it was, at least at one time, a relatively inexpensive form of programming that he knew could be relied on to draw a dependable audience. Some people say that Ted enjoyed having something that was regarded as being more downscale in nature. He enjoyed having that on the air and sort of sticking it in the face of people who thought that kind of programming wouldn't be successful. But I think within the corporate entity, obviously WCW had a lot of enemies. There were a lot of people that were quite frankly embarrassed to have WCW on the airwaves and openly campaign for it to be taken off the air.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, as you go more into the story and you learn more about WCW and its ultimate fate, there are some things that happen where you can sort of explore the notion that perhaps there was some intentional moves taken to make WCW's performance look worse than it actually was. At the very least, there were some measures taken that made it more difficult for WCW to succeed. But that's something in the book we just try to lay out as much as is possible. The data, the facts, the perspectives of people from various aspects of the business, and then it's up to people to make their own minds up when it comes to that.
Okay, in closing, what do you want the fans to take away from this book after reading it?
Well, I think what I would hope people would take away from this is maybe just a recognition that, first of all, I would hope that they find the book entertaining and informative, mm-hmm. and learned a lot from it and enjoyed the general structure of the book and my approach to writing it. But I think also a recognition that WCW did not exist in a vacuum by virtue of its relationship in the broadcasting that we talked about a lot today.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a standalone entity. It was a subsidiary of as part of a larger broadcasting empire. So obviously that relationship manifested itself and played out in a number of really interesting ways. And I think that dynamic between the two is really one of the central driving forces in terms of narrative within the book. So I think that's something that we maybe all have to remember when we're looking back on any entity that's part of a wider corporate structure, is that, yes, the on-screen or creative decisions that happened or didn't happen are obviously tremendously important in terms of looking back on WCW and what happened to it. But I do think there's a broader story at play. And after reading this book, I think that will become very much apparent to the readers. Apart from that, I think I would hope that they would go away and sort of enjoy the fact that, as I mentioned, over 120 perspectives have informed this book. And by virtue of that alone, I would hope that they would sort of regard this as being a very original look at what is a very fascinating time period.
All right. So if fans want to buy this book, where can they go? It's on Amazon, and isn't there a website as well?
That's correct, yeah. So they can go one or two places. Again, the name of the book is Nitro for the Incredible Rise and Inevitable Collapse of Ted Turner's WCW. So they can go either to Amazon.com or, for that matter, you know, .co.uk, Amazon Canada, Australia, wherever you happen to be, it should be up there for you. Alternatively, you can order directly through WCWNitroBook.com. So either one of those places, you can check them out and kind of compare for yourself and make a decision. So those would be the two places to get the book.
Right. Guy Evans, everybody. Also, be sure to check out his podcast, Secrets of Nitro, with his co-host, Neil Pruitt. I believe it's on hiatus right now, is it?
Actually, by the time people hear this, Ryan, we should have a new episode up there. It looks as though we're probably going to continue the podcast on more of a sporadic basis. It won't be sort of a weekly affair. But yes, people can type in Neil Pruitt's Secrets of WCW Nitro, or just type in Secrets of WCW Nitro, and you can listen to, I think it's around 35 episodes or so, where one of the main producers involved with WCW goes into one of the behind-the-scenes stories from that time, so you can check that out as well.
All right, looking forward to it. Guy Evans, everyone, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome, thank you.
Special thanks goes out to Guy Evans for coming on to talk about his new book. This WCW Nitro book is a very interesting read if you're a wrestling fan, and if anyone listening who hasn't read it yet should definitely check it out.
Yeah, that sounds like a good book, Daddy. Too bad he couldn't talk about the time that Tank Abbott was the manager for 3Count.
Wait, what? You actually remember that?
Yeah, Daddy, that Tank Abbott is one cool cat. I even grew out my beard just like he did for my high school prom. When I left the house, my sister said I looked like a billy goat, but she didn't know what she was talking about. Tank Abbott was my main man.
You did what? You went to your high school prom looking like Tank Abbott?
Yeah, he's one of my favorites. Look, I'm even wearing his t-shirt right now.
Wait, let me see that. Wait, that's a Tank Abbott shirt? Where the hell did you get this?
Oh, I got it from the back trunks in some dude's car in an abandoned Edgar's parking lot 19 years ago. Look at it. It looks like him.
That looks like Tank Abbott. That's a picture of a stick man. It looks like someone drew it with a Sharpie and just handed it back to you real quick.
I know, ain't that something? Best $50 I ever spent.
Oh boy, did they see you coming. Anyways, on our next edition of the Throwback, everybody, we have another special guest. We have one of the members of the Sandlot coming on. Shane Obedinsky, who played Tommy Repeat Timmons, will be on the show to talk about the 25th anniversary of the film and his time filming the popular movie.
I can't wait for that, Daddy. You think he's a Tank Abbott fan, too?
I need some fresh air. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out on Twitter at Throw Podcast or on the web at www.blogtalkradio.com/throwback.